Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hello everyone, it's Jesse Green here. Welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It is fantastic to have you here, as it always is. Now, this episode is an absolute cracker. We are talking about leadership, and my guest today is someone who is a leader and has been a leader in various different spheres. Whether we're talking about corporate life, he's led large corporations, he's been in the entrepreneurial space, he's been a speaker, he's an author, and a whole lot more in between. So Martin Moore is my guest, and we're talking about leadership, but we're talking about leadership from a very practical point of view. This is not academic theory. This is not stuff that you read in a book. This is the practical application of leadership skills to achieve outcomes. And this is really about outcomes-based leadership. So how can we move the business forward? Yes, we want to bring people with us. Yes, we want to be the best version of ourselves. Yes, we want to empower people, but it's all about leadership to get results. So as you go on your practice journey of profitable to scalable and valuable, the demands of us as leaders change, you know, new level, new devil. And so what we talk about in this particular episode is, how do you get that balance right between delegating by abdication, so you just hand things off, without feeling the need to micromanage at the other end of the spectrum? How do you get that right level of accountability, that right level of supervision, so you're confident that things are being done? And how do you develop a culture of accountability so people are very aware of what their results are that they need to achieve? We talk about creating empowerment with team. We talk about the attributes of great leaders. We talk about a bunch of stuff in between. And what's really interesting about this episode, as I said a moment ago, is it's very practical, very actionable. So like I'm fond of saying, is you want to have a pen and paper handy, because you will want to take some notes on this. I guarantee I took a ton of notes as I was listening to Martin as well. Now, Martin has a new book coming out shortly, and it's called No Bullshit Leadership. And so forgive the cuss word in that and a few cuss words that come up in our conversation. But I think this is going to be a book that you want to get a hold of, and you can head across to his website to do that. And if you want to find out more about his resources, you can head to yourceomentor.com and find out a bunch of free stuff there as well. But for now, let's have the conversation with Martin, and I hope you enjoy this as much as I enjoyed recording it.
Martin, welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time. How are you today, mate?
I'm great, thanks, Jesse. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, mate, it's my pleasure. And as we're talking off air, you've come very highly recommended to me from someone near and dear to me. And every time we talk about leadership, he's said to me a few times, you've got to get Martin Moore onto your podcast, because I know your audience will really love him. He's a smart dude and a really good speaker. So thank you once again. I'm really looking forward to it.
No, it's an absolute pleasure. Me too, Jesse.
Martin, you've had an interesting career path. You've worked in corporate, you've gone into other fields. And of course, we want to talk a lot about leadership today. And you've had the opportunity to observe leaders, be a leader in all different environments. But I guess one of the things I wanted to start our conversation with is really clearly defining what leadership is. And I realize that might sound like a basic place to start, but I want to make sure that we get a good, clear understanding on what leadership is, because I've noticed in the past that sometimes people confuse leadership and management, or leadership and kind of direction and all those other sorts of things. As we start our conversation, if we could just get some clarity about how you see leadership, what it is, how it evolves, whether leaders are made or born, just a bit of a general perspective on leadership. And then I'd like to ask you a little bit about your background.
Okay. That's a great way to start, Jesse. It's very often that I get stumped on the first question, but you've actually done that for me, which is excellent. In the book, No Bullshit Leadership, that's being released next month in the US, I talk about what leadership isn't, because it's really hard to actually define what leadership is. It's much easier to say it's not this and it's not that. But fundamentally for me, leadership is about marshalling the resources that are given to you in your organization, people, finance, assets, and so forth, to get particular outcomes and to create value for your employer. That's it. Full stop, pure and simple. So your job as a leader is to find a way to use all of the things you've got to create value. Now, the crossover between leadership and management is a really interesting one, because I believe the two are actually inseparable. what a lot of people have been talking about over the last several years is managers are people who try and get results through making people do things, and leaders are higher order people, higher order thinkers, the benevolent, virtuous people who come in and motivate people and get them moving in the right direction. I think to be a great leader, you also have to be a good manager. And to be a good manager, you also have to be a great leader. I find the two quite inseparable. And I'm sure we'll talk about it a bit more, because you and I spoke just a little while ago about how you actually get the right level of oversight while still letting people be motivated to do what they do and without falling into that command and control mode, which is more likely associated with a manager.
Mm.
Let me just round this off by saying the ultimate question over red wine, are leaders born or made? I think some people have a greater propensity to leadership. They find it easier. It's more in their DNA. But anyone can become a leader, and anyone can become a really great leader if they take a few practical steps, because mostly it's about habits, discipline, and behaviors. And it's about self-mastery. And anyone can be on that path to self-mastery. And as a leader, the most important thing you can do is be in control of yourself and be the best you can be for your people. So, yes, anyone can. Leaders are made, not born. There's a controversial one for you first out.
I actually really like that, because, you know, one of the things I really enjoy about a little bit of controversy is, because you hear the standard dogma, you know, leaders are the higher order thinkers, managers are the doers, leaders are not necessarily made, but they could be born or have some genetic predisposition or some sort of super talent or whatever. And what I really appreciate what you're saying is, let's just get to the heart of it. Leadership is really about utilizing the resources to achieve outcomes. And I really appreciate that. And I know a lot of our audience will appreciate that as well. What I wanted to ask you a little bit about, just again, while we're getting clarity about what leadership isn't, as you've articulated, and indeed what it may be, is, does leadership vary from one perspective to another? And this is where I wanted to tap into your background, your career, because you've worked in so many different areas. And obviously there's leadership styles that might vary from one situation to another, but do the fundamental principles of leadership remain constant and stable throughout those different environments? Or do they change depending on the environment? I understand the style might change, but what about the principles, the underpinnings? Are they relatively stable?
They are absolutely rock solid stable. So I believe that everyone as an individual has a completely different leadership style. And it's rooted in so many things in our past, in our upbringing, in our education and everything else. I say that people have a leadership fingerprint that's absolutely unique. So you can't lead like me and I can't lead like you. And that's not good or bad. It's just the way it is. So it's critical that we recognize the fact that we're each individual and unique, and that we apply the principles that are well-worn and tested the way we can apply them. So, for example, if I'm an arrogant person, I will struggle to become more humble, even though everyone tells me I need to be humble. And so what I need to do is work out how to minimize that and effectively use the leadership tools to make sure that that isn't a deterrent or a detractor from my team's performance.
That's really interesting. And I really like the idea of the leadership fingerprint, because, again, sometimes I've been guilty in the past of reading a book around enhancing my own leadership and thinking I've got to be something that I'm not. And it's like wearing someone else's shoes. It's uncomfortable. It feels weird. And if ultimately you discard it and you go back to old habits and you don't make the progress that you want to make. But what I wanted to just talk about for a moment is, I had my background in the Navy. I'm a dentist by profession, as you know. And my first career was in the Navy. And of course, the way leadership was taught in the Navy, probably not even taught, the way it kind of evolved was, whoever has the most stripes on their shoulder tends to be the leader and calls the shots. And it's very much that command and control type of leadership style that we talk about. One of the challenges for dentists that we face is, most of us are really perfectionistic. Most of us like things done just so. We struggle when things aren't done just the way we want them. And sometimes we're wrestling with this notion of having really high expectations and then finding it hard to direct or lead people in a way that allows our expectations to be met. And I wanted to just talk to you a little bit about expectation management, setting standards, how to help others meet those standards so that we can, I guess, have the things that we need from our team, but in a way that doesn't feel like we've got to sit over their shoulder and, in essence, do their job with them while they're doing it. So could we just have a bit of a conversation about, for those of us who are a little bit perfectionistic in nature, and how to kind of get the best out of people without sitting on their shoulder?
Yeah, well, let's start with the punchline, Jesse. Perfectionism is the enemy of achievement.
It sure is.
And as long as you're a perfectionist, because I am a recovering perfectionist, when I first was tested for personality through one of the corporate instruments they use, they found that I was quite high on my perfectionism mm-hmm. and less so on my achievement orientation. Mm. And I worked for a lot of years by doing different practical things to change that balance. So I'm now extraordinarily achievement oriented and my perfectionism is much lower, even though it still pops its ugly head up occasionally. Mm. Now, the reason it's such a problem is that if you're a perfectionist, nothing's ever going to be good enough.
Yeah.
If you try and put that on your team, they start to become afraid of making decisions, afraid of producing the outputs you've asked them for. They're worried that it might not be good enough. And so you push them into a corner where they actually freeze and don't produce.
Hmm.
So one of my most common expressions in the last several years of my corporate career as a CEO was, that's good enough. Like, it doesn't have to be perfect. That's good enough. Keep moving. Because in my view, momentum is massively more valuable than perfection. When we talk about decision-making, making any sort of decision, you can make a decision based on the facts and data you have at the time and the consultation you can undertake and the judgment you have from your experience. You can make that decision or you can procrastinate and wait for more data and wait for more consultation and wait for more inputs. But my firm view, after what I've seen in 30-plus years of corporate leadership, is a decision that's 80% right today is infinitely better than a decision that's 85% right next week, which is infinitely better than a decision that's 90% right in a month's time.
Mm.
Momentum is everything. So keep moving, adjust as you go. And funnily enough, you can make really, really good decisions in a fraction of the time you think it takes to make them that way.
So let's talk about that, because I understand the value of momentum. I understand that when you've got the ball rolling, it's easier to keep it rolling than to stop and try and get it moving again from zero. How do you keep momentum and how do you make sure that you engage the team with that and you can measure that? What's that feel like at the coalface? How do you know you've got momentum?
You'll know you've got momentum because just the pace of the business is tangibly different. You can feel a difference in how things get done. So how quickly work is turned around, how smoothly decisions are made, how little procrastination there is around the things that are most important. So you'll feel that change. You'll measure it in your results. And I'm a massive believer in results. Like, as a leader, if you're not there to get results, what are you there for? Mm-hmm. That's it. Deliver value. First and foremost, that's the centerpiece of everything that we talk about, is delivering value. The thing that you've got to work out as a leader is what value means for you, because in your context, it's going to be different from another context. What does it mean for your industry, your organization, your markets, and this point in time? And so there's a vast array of ways to create value. It can be financial value, of course, which we always think about when someone says value,
mm-hmm.
but it can also be providing a safer work environment for your employees if you're in an industrial business or running a manufacturing operation. It can be, in a dental practice, better post-procedural outcomes for your patients, or it can be something as little as working out how to reduce and minimize the stress that a patient would feel prior to a visit by undertaking certain things to prepare. So whatever it is that creates value for your key stakeholders, that's what you have to focus your resources on and focus your energies on.
And I guess thinking about results and thinking about accountability, that culture that you have, accountability that you're trying to create, clearly as the founder of the business, the owner of the business, often that culture is going to stem from that person. You would have worked in some great cultures, I imagine, and maybe you've had some experiences working in cultures that weren't as productive, weren't as supportive.
Yes, he says in a leading way.
You don't need to name them, but I'm joking, of course, that we don't need to name them at all. But what I wanted to understand around that is culture is obviously something you can create by intent rather than by default. And creating that culture of accountability, whether it is results focused and, of course, you know, being able to get that momentum, as we spoke about a moment ago, being able to make those decisions. And to your point about 80% done is 100% awesome kind of thing is great. But I wanted to just talk about the culture of accountability and what you've seen work from that perspective versus things that have not worked. And I guess what I'm trying to pull out of you or tease out of you is some practical things that people listening to this show will be able to say, well, what sort of things could I be doing to increase the level of accountability, to drive those results, deliver value? As you say, it's not necessarily financial value, although it could be, but other things as well.
Let me just start with the word culture. Every single business or organization, in fact, any place where two or more people congregate, there is a culture, which is just an accepted way of behaving. It's the how we do things around here. That's all it is. Culture is incredible. I find it fascinating because culture is like the wind. You can't see it, but you can absolutely feel it. And you put a boat on the ocean with the same sails, the same structure, the same crew, the same ocean, it can be completely different as an experience depending on the wind. There's a wind that will carry you swiftly to your destination, and there's a wind that will rip the sails from the masts and sink you. And that's what culture is. And so I find that fascinating just to think about it in those terms. The second thing about culture is that it is completely different from location to location based upon what the leader creates. And this is a revelation I had when I was running CS Energy. When I left there in 2018 after my five-year contract, I looked around that organization, and there were some pockets of that organization I could walk through and say, that culture in that team there, that's as good as you will find in any organization anywhere on the planet. And I love it, and I'm so proud of it. And there were other parts of the organization I could go to, and I was absolutely embarrassed that that was the result after 5 years of my leadership.
Oh, wow.
And so you don't have one culture in an organization, depending on the size. You may have many. You may have dozens, depending on the company and its locations and its leaders. And now with working from home and the remote and virtual workforce, you may have hundreds of cultures. Because my home office with my two pets, three kids, and a wife who's working from home as well might be completely different to yours, who's a single person in a loft in Manhattan. So you have this development of multiple different cultures, and keeping that in a way that promotes the culture you want is much more difficult now.
It's really interesting that you talk about that, and the concept of having different cultures in different parts of the business, I think, is really important. When you went through CS Energy and you saw those departments with a great culture, you felt that sense of pride, and then you went through the other departments where perhaps the culture was not what you'd hoped for.
To say the least.
Okay. I'm trying to...
You're being very kind, Jesse.
I'm being very gentle.
Let's call a spade a spade, mate. It's let's no call a spade leadership for a reason.
Yeah, it was shit house.
It was terrible.
But the thing I want to ask you is, what insights came about for you? Because you've got these two departments and you're going, hang on, this one's so good and this one's not. What did you reflect on and go, how did that happen? Where did my leadership or those departments kind of diverge from your central leadership? How did one department flourish while the other one didn't?
Yes, well, it comes to, and that's the $64,000 question, Jesse, because it comes down to, in my view, the local leader.
Yeah.
So if I have a small team of, say, a dozen people, and I'm leading that team, I can turn that into a high-performing team, or I can turn it into a cultural backwater, depending on how I choose to do things, the standards I choose to uphold, how much risk I'm prepared to take as a leader to bring the team through, how much I let them run me instead of me run them in terms of what they put forward in the culture, how much courage I put into the mix when I go into work each day, and how much I think I can bullshit the boss above me to keep him off my back. And in an organization where you're talking about perhaps, I don't know, five, six levels, some places seven between the CEO and the people who are actually doing the work on the ground floor, there's a lot of interpretation and translation that goes on there. And there's a massive dilution of messages that come from the corner office. So in my head, our strategy and our intent and the standards we were setting was absolutely crystal clear, unequivocal. There was no question as to what we were setting. But even my direct reports, one layer away, experienced executives getting paid a ton of money would translate it slightly differently because they have different world experiences. They have different philosophical viewpoints. They have different teams to manage. And so even at that next layer down, you see it dilute. And so you can imagine that dilution going through multiple layers. When you get to the front line, unless you're constantly vigilant, who knows what you're getting?
So essentially it's lost in translation along the way. And I guess the question then is, there'll be someone listening to this and going, hey, I might not have a seven deep organizational structure, but I do find what I'm trying to convey is getting lost in translation, whether it's one layer, two layer, three layers. How do you go back and re-communicate that? Is it a case of really then saying, this is what I mean, do you understand? Is it a case of over-communicating? What's the appropriate level of communication to make sure that the translation is or the message is received loud and clear in the correct manner?
Yeah, really good question, Jesse, because I think there are multiple aspects to this. The first is, if you say something once, no one's going to pick it up.
Yeah.
If you say it three times, some people start to get the clue. If you're saying it seven or eight times and it just becomes a mantra, that's when people start to go, oh, actually, maybe Martin's saying this. Another really important aspect to it is the channel you use and then how much you listen. So sending out an email from the corner office, Most people aren't going to read it. Some will. Most will misinterpret it if they do read it. So you've really got to have that local translation. What does this mean to me in my work group or my team, and how do I apply these principles that have come from above? But as I said, listening's critical. And for me, the thing about determining whether or not certain teams or groups in the organization are getting the message, I like to listen for echoes. Now, it's one thing for me to say, here's what we're looking for, bang, bang, bang. I can say that till I'm blue in the face. But what I want to hear is the leader two or three layers away from me saying that to their team. So I'm listening for echoes. And if I don't hear an echo and I get the opportunity without breaking chain of command, because it's important that you have some level of authority, that you don't disempower the leaders in between you and the one you're talking to. But I'll just say to them, talk to me about this. Tell me why you think that's important, and tell me why you're not emphasizing this, and tell me what this means in your context. It's understanding. It's listening for those echoes. And when you don't hear them, giving them an opportunity to have an engaged conversation.
It's really interesting. And the structure that you've spoken about being able to really listen to get those echoes back, again, reminds me that I've got a friend of mine who is someone who I respect. And he said to me a little while ago, Jesse, I think you're communicating about adequately when people start rolling your eyes. Yeah, because like we've heard this all before, kind of routine. And of course, he was being glib, but I guess the point he was making is you've got to be constantly communicating, constantly repeating the message. And as you say, hearing those echoes coming back at you in a way that is showing that it's been, you know, received in the way that you intended. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the multi-layered organizational structure as well, because I think there's a lot of people listening to this program who are really interested in transitioning out of a typical owner-operated dental practice, you know, the one that does the service delivery, or in our case, dentistry by day, trying to run the business by night. And that is a challenging type of practice to run. But a lot of them want to transition to a business that is a true business, where you've got some leverage, you've got some team, you've got some systems and processes, and you free up some time. And that does necessitate bringing other people on the journey with them. And so what I wanted to ask in your experience is, I was reflecting on your conversation about the, you know, 5-6 layer deep organizational structure and having layers between the coalface and the CEO. When it comes to developing other people's leadership skills and helping them, you've obviously had to develop your own leadership skills, but in terms of developing other leaders, what things have you seen be effective in that space?
Well, Jesse, this is probably the most complex area of leadership, and I am mindful of the fact that we haven't gone down the path of accountability. You've asked me three times, and I will get there eventually, but I do want to talk about accountability. Yep. But I think the transitions to different layers of leadership are really important, because we're not told how to do it. We get a promotion, there's no one that says, okay, well, now you've been promoted to another level. Here are the sorts of things you're going to need to watch out for. Here are the sorts of relationships you'll need to develop. Here are the things that are now important to you. Here's your new time horizon. All of these things are left for us to learn by osmosis. And if we don't have a really strong, capable leader that we work for, we will learn all of those bad habits and do it the way our previous leader did. Now, coming from the other direction, when a business is growing and an owner is trying to pull themselves out of that structure, there are a couple of really important things. So the first thing is working at the right level, and not dipping down into your people's work is an absolute given. You have to be able to stay in your lane and let your people do the jobs they're being paid to do. The way a lot of leaders fail early on, and in fact right through their careers, is they overcompensate for the people in their teams who aren't performing. It's much, much easier to just roll your sleeves up and do something when someone hasn't done it the right way than it is to actually lead them and explain to them what the minimum acceptable standard is and to raise their performance to that standard. Because that takes risk, it takes confrontation, it takes all of those things that we're not really comfortable with as humans, and it takes longer, it's harder. It's there's a whole range of things that push us away from doing that. But as long as we are looking over our people's shoulders, as long as we are compensating for them when they don't perform, we will never have a capable team, and we will always be tied to that team. So I'm a massive believer in stay back and up in your role, create a vacuum that people have to move into to perform their roles. And when they don't, they need the feedback and the guidance and the support to lift into that role. If they choose not to do that, there have to be consequences. And so this is how you actually build a team that is capable and competent and can do things the way you're happy with. Now, you'll never be 100% happy. I mean, let's face it, No one can ever do the job as well as you. You've got really particular standards, particularly if you're a recovering perfectionist like we are. You have standards that are high and you want people to meet those standards. It's really hard to let a paper go through to a board meeting that has spelling or grammatical errors in it. But sometimes you've got to do it, because if you're there nitpicking, the signal you're sending back to your people and the author of that paper is, that work's not good enough. I'm going to fix it for you. And they get into that mode of, well, nothing's good enough for Martin. I guess I'd better do it.
Interesting, because that takes us back to the accountability discussion. So we've got another nice segue back to that.
I reckon I might deal with it this time, Jesse.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that, because I think what you've really spoken very elegantly and eloquently about is creating that vacuum and staying in your own lane, up and back, away from the coalface. Because what we spoke about off air was there's a tendency for lots of us in dentistry to want to hover, to want to oversee, to micromanage. And there's this kind of pendulum that swings between micromanagement and it's like an abdication rather than a delegation. And so it's like throwing someone a ball and just hoping they'll run with it. And there's obviously that happy medium. So can we talk about where accountability lies in that process, what it looks like, how it's implemented? And as you say, the consequences of not meeting those standards, because I think that's the key thing, is to really articulate what that person is accountable for, what the result is that they've got to achieve. So could we just get back to the accountability, please, mate?
Absolutely. I really like the way you framed that, because you have to make it really clear to people what they're accountable to achieve. That is absolutely fundamental. And in my view, the number one thing that organizations could do to improve is to implement really strong single point accountability. That's one head to pat, one ass to kick. No exceptions. Anything needs to be done, there has to be really clear ownership. And things happen differently when that level of ownership is applied. People treat the problem completely differently. So if you have shared accountability, which I say is equal to no accountability, and you ask someone what they're doing, they say, oh, yeah, I'm going pretty well, but Jenny's doing this bit over here and Mike's doing that bit over there, and I don't really know who's bringing it all together, but, you know, I'm doing a good job. I'm doing my bit. And this is the all care, no responsibility culture that you develop when that's the case. Mm. It's very, very different from having someone who knows that they're the ones that have to front up with this result. And if something goes wrong, they don't sit back and wonder whether Jenny or Mike's going to fix it. They go, shit, it's a problem. I better talk to Martin, because I don't know what's going to happen here. And I've got to get some advice or some guidance, or maybe I need to slip the project by a couple of weeks or whatever they deem to be the right solution. But they're energized towards solving problems, not towards passing the buck. And that's a really completely different way of doing things. Now, when you give that strength of accountability, people are going to be afraid of that. So what you have to do is empower them and give them the tools and support to be successful. Mm. So the way I see it, accountability and empowerment are two sides of the same coin. You cannot have one without the other. And in fact, if you want to implement really strong single point accountabilities, you can't start there. You'll scare the shit out of people. They'll run a mile. They'll find a way to duck and go underground.
Yep.
You have to start with empowerment. Let them start making decisions. Show them that they can have an impact in their environment. Show them that when you give them something to do, they can make some choices and decisions themselves. And to do that, you've got to be happy to stand back and let them make some mistakes. And that's not necessarily in our psyche to do that. We see someone just about to trip over and we step in and go, whoa, hang on, don't do that. You might trip over. But if you think of it like the very simple analogy of raising kids, when one of your kids is learning to ride a bike, you let them fall off. You have to. Otherwise, they're not going to learn to stay upright.
Yep.
And they might get a few grazed knees or elbows. At the very worst, they'll break their wrist, but it's not going to be fatal.
Hmm.
And you'll allow that to happen so that they can learn. Now, I'm not saying you allow that same child to run out into a busy road. That's fatal. No. You stop them from doing that, you intervene. So it's that matter of knowing how much rope to give them to let them learn and fail and grow, and when to step in and say, well, hang on a minute, you're just about to have a disaster. Let me help you.
Yeah.
That requires judgment, and it requires not just judgment of the task and the organization, but of the individual. Every single individual is different. And so even though the fundamentals of leadership are identical, no matter where you are, the way you apply them, depending on the maturity of the person you're leading, might be entirely different.
Mm.
So you've got to be mindful of those individual differences and adapt accordingly.
It's really interesting you say this, because for those people listening, there'll be the recovering perfectionists and perhaps the yet to recover perfectionists listening to this show. And the idea of letting someone make a decision with the autonomy and letting them fail is going to require some emotional courage from them to be able to allow that to occur. So before I ask you a little bit about empowerment and accountability, I wanted to ask you about the emotional journey that the leader has to go on to be okay with that. Because intellectually, that makes perfect sense. And then you know where I'm going, right?
Totally.
But on an emotional level, that's harder for someone to necessarily go along with and to support. And even though it makes perfect sense, they get it, old habits die hard. How do you manage the emotional response within yourself if you're that leader that has to allow someone else to make those decisions and be willing for them to fail, to make a bit of a faux pas, or frankly, make some mistakes that could hurt you but not kill you?
Yeah, and that's really the crux of it, isn't it? Because leadership is about emotion and emotional intelligence and empathy and being able to connect with people in a way that enables you to have the power to do the hard things.
Yeah.
One of my favorite quotes is that if people trust and respect you, there's nothing you can't say to them. In terms of getting our head around how to lead, it takes courage, it takes discipline. And standing back while you watch someone make a mistake that you know is going to help them grow in a way that's not going to damage the business is a discipline. It's really, really hard to do, particularly when you can easily solve it for them.
Yep.
But if you go in and solve it for them, guess what? You're going to be doing that for the next 10 years.
Yep.
You're just going to have to keep stepping in. You will never get out of their way and you'll never give them the opportunity to grow and develop.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you want to build capability, which in my view is the number one mandate for a leader, is to build capability below them. If you want to build capability, you better get good at letting people try some things, learn, fail, apply their judgment, get better. You want to see that trend of improvement, because trend is your friend. You don't want someone making mistakes year in, year out. There's got to be a point where you say, hang on a minute, this isn't quite working. Let's have a different chat. Let's talk about this. But really important that you're connected enough to know where those levels are, where those limits are, and then to support your people as they go through them, and to be able to become a guide rather than a controller. So as a guide, you watch what people are doing. And if they look like they're going too far out of bounds, you might have a chat with them and say, hey, tell me how this project's going. And they'll tell you what's going on. And you say, that's really interesting. Sounds like you're right on top of it. Have you thought about this thing here? Because it occurs to me, I don't know, obviously I'm not as close to it as you, but it occurs to me that this might be a risk that you may need to have under control a bit better than it is. And just point them in the right direction to say, here's a hole, there's a hole. Just try and have a think about those. So you can add a lot of value to them without stepping over their decision-making rights and their autonomy.
And that was actually where I was going to go with the question I had about empowerment, because what we've spoken about is allowing people to make decisions. Is there more to empowerment than really just giving them the autonomy to make those decisions? Or is there another element to that that we're not talking about, or have we pretty much nailed it?
No. There's loads of elements to empowerment. So the first thing is, you can't empower someone unless you have real clarity of objectives for them.
Mm.
And we spoke about this in terms of the accountability.
Accountability, yeah.
You've got to give people that absolute crystal clear understanding of what it is that good looks like. So yeah, people are relatively straightforward when push comes to shove. They want to know three things when they turn up to work each day.
Mm-hmm.
What are your expectations of me? How am I performing against those expectations? And what does my future hold? So you've got to be able to give them extreme clarity around those three things. And you can't do that unless you have an ongoing conversation, unless you're in a dialogue with them that goes across formal and informal conversations and all sorts of communication. Unless you're in that dialogue and you can give them that certainty of what good looks like, you won't get the right performance. So that's the first step to empowerment. Show them where the scoreboard is.
Yep.
Show them how to make the score tick over. That's the number one fundamental. And there's a whole range of things like resource people properly. Don't send them off on a fool's errand. You know, if I want you to do a job and I give you $1 million and five people, well, that's fine. But what if it was something that actually required $10 million and 50 people?
Mm.
You're just under-resourced. It's a fool's errand. How much air cover do I provide for you from irrational decisions that come down from above and from interfering peers? How much say do you have in formulating the deadlines for a project? There's a whole range of things that we do that add up to empowerment. Mm. And most importantly, how available am I to support you on the way through? Because you're going to have questions and issues and problems. How close do you feel to me that you can come and seek my guidance when you have problems? Without, of course, intervening in their agency, they've still got to be adult. They've still got to decide when to come to you with what. but that's a really important factor too. So empowerment is a huge area, and it's really hard to get right because for different people, they require different levels of empowerment. Some people are just happy you give them a task and they'll just run off and do it. And you get out of my face, Mark. I'm doing this for you. I'll deliver it. I know what I'm doing. You stay away and I'll deliver it to you. And they'll do that reliably every time. Other people, you give them a task and then within 15 minutes, they're back in the office and could you just run this bit past me again? I didn't quite get this bit. Everything you said after, I'm just about to give you a job. Could you just repeat that?
Can you just repeat it?
Yeah, in fact,
speaking to this recorder so I can play it back a few times. Yeah,
absolutely. And they'd be back in your office twice a week asking you questions that you think you've already covered off, but they need that certainty and security. So,
and I guess some people are really happy to say, give me the objective and the outcome and I'll find a way to navigate my way to there, whereas other people interested in the path to getting there as well. And maybe they're concerned about the journey as much as the destination. And what I'm hearing from you is, you know, some people just need the path illuminated a bit more for them, whereas others are quite happy to get the machete out and find the path or create the path themselves. Is that a fair thing?
Yes, it's really good interpretation of it. And can I just say, Jesse, that those people that go off and decide they're going to take the machete out and cut the path for themselves, as a leader, you've got to make sure they don't get lost in the jungle.
Totally.
Because sometimes they go, you think they're okay, they're off on a track, and then you find they're missing in action. No one's seen Pete for 3 months. Anyone see where he went? Oh, yeah. He's in the middle of the Amazon rainforest, cutting his way through.
Yeah, but it's still on the payroll.
Totally. Yeah, so you just got to be careful that you are close enough to it to see the outputs coming through. And this is, you were talking about this earlier in terms of how do you actually have a level of oversight that isn't overbearing, where you do give people their autonomy, but you're close enough to know what's going on. And funnily enough, that was my biggest challenge during my leadership career was that one thing, because I would always take someone on face value and trust them and say, you know, particularly in more senior roles, you're experienced, you're intelligent, you know what you're doing, I've explained everything to you, off you go and show me how you can perform. And I would quite often give them too much rope and too much time in between looking at their outputs and looking at the milestones. So I learned in the last 5 to 8 years of my career to get much, much closer to people who were going off and doing things just to make sure they were on track and to make sure that they weren't doing anything that was like going out of bounds or not progressing something that I thought they were progressing. I got into the habit of, with people who were new, having very, very frequent touch points. I like to call it short interval control. And basically, for example, and I use this example in my book, an executive came to me once and he was lined up to develop a strategy. And I asked him how long he thought it would take to put this strategy together. He had a consulting team coming in. It was a pretty big deal. And he said, look, I think it's probably going to take me about 4 months. I said, okay, that's awesome. Very happy with 4 months. That sounds like it's on a timeline. But next Friday week, 2 weeks from today, I want you to come back to me and show me a draft mud map of where you're going with it.
Yeah.
I just want to shoot the breeze, right? I don't care if you've got it on the back of a table napkin. In a couple of weeks' time, I just want to see where you're going, make sure that we're speaking the same language, we're heading the same direction, and then go for your life. So this does a couple of things. The first thing is it pushes them to act quickly. On a four-month timeline, sometimes people wait 3.5 months to start.
Yep.
You know, it's like a task expands to fill the time made available for it. So sometimes you get that. And other times people can just go off on the wrong direction because they don't understand sufficiently what you want.
Yes.
And so they'll go off an unproductive path. And if you wait for 4 months for that output to come back to you, it could be completely off base.
Yes.
So it helps you calibrate. It helps you coach and guide them. And it also makes sure that the activity and momentum is actually sufficient to actually deliver a quality result when you need it.
Yeah. So you touched on your book a moment ago, and the title of the book is called No Bullshit Leadership. And I'm curious to ask about the genesis of the title, because it does imply that elsewhere there might be a touch of the bullshit. So I'm curious to ask, what prompted you to write that book? What was the key message or key idea or key problem that you saw that you thought, I really want to address this? And obviously, it's a catchy title. I understand why you'd have that title, but I'm curious to understand the reasoning for the title beyond the marketing piece.
Sure. Well, for the book itself, we actually pitched a number of potential titles to the publisher in the US, Rosetta Books, and the CEO of that publishing house said, I like all these titles you've pitched, but I want to use the same name as your podcast, No Bullshit Leadership. He said, I just love it. That's great. So basically, the publisher chose it. And as I said, it came from our podcast, No Bullshit Leadership. Now, When I put that together, and of course, for those of you who don't know in the audience, I'm in business with my 31-year-old daughter, Emma Green. She's basically the brains and the drive behind the outfit. And when I first decided to leave corporate, which was probably a couple of years before I finished my stint at CS Energy, I thought I might write a book. And she said, Dad, a book is so 2010. Let's get with the times. So that's when we decided to put the podcast out. And the rationale behind the podcast and the book and all the content we have is exactly the same. These are practical tools that get results. That's it. And leadership isn't easy. Leadership's really, really hard because it does take discipline and habit and doing things you aren't programmed to do if you want to be really good at it. And it's putting self-interest aside so that you can make decisions in the greater good. There's a whole range of things that are counterintuitive to us. And so having the tools to do that and to learn to be better is really where all of our content focuses. Now, the concept of other pieces of leadership content being bullshit, I won't speak ill of anyone.
No.
If anyone can find a market and there are people in the world who find that useful, happy days, right?
Mm.
But I must admit, Jesse, it did grind my gears a little bit to see how far we've removed the process of leadership from the need to get results.
Mm.
And so leadership seems to have become a conversation about noble leadership attributes. It's about virtue signaling, right?
Mm.
Great leaders are humble. Yes. Great leaders are courageous. Great leaders are fallible. Great leaders are transparent. Great leaders are whatever, right?
Yep.
And we listen to this stuff and it motivates us and it inspires us and we feel all warm and fuzzy inside. And then we go away and we do absolutely nothing.
Mm.
We don't do anything different. And so the people we're leading, we think we're becoming better leaders by listening to all of the feel-good stuff, but it's like a short-term sugar hit.
Mm.
And the people who lead us still see the same incompetent boss that they saw last year because we haven't developed.
Mm.
And so my whole thing is get the tools and start to use them.
Yeah.
If you don't use them, you're not going to improve. If you do use them, you'll improve. Doesn't matter who you are or where you are, what level you're at, what size your business is, you will improve. And that's really what drives everything we do. So is humility great for a leader? I don't know. Maybe it's good. I mean,
I guess if it's part of the fingerprint, maybe. If it's not your fingerprint, it's probably not.
Yeah, it depends what other factors are going on. So, for example, if you're humble and decisive, that is like rocket fuel for your team. It's so powerful. But if you're humble and indecisive, it's disastrous.
Mm.
A humble and indecisive person, your people lose confidence in you so fast it's not funny.
Mm.
So we talk about the noble attributes, but they don't tell the whole story. And they certainly don't have that practical view of, okay, if I decided I did want to be more humble, well, how would that happen? Where would I start? What would I do?
I think the topic on virtue signaling is something that strikes a chord with me.
Yeah.
I pay attention to what gets published and like you, I don't have any bad words to say about anyone. If they're doing their best work and helping people, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
But it does strike me that there is virtue signaling happening left, right, and center at the moment in all manner of arenas. And it does seem that I'm all for being humble and I'm all for being vulnerable and all those other sorts of things, but I'm also really for results. And for me, maybe this is going to sound a little bit direct and maybe it's going to sound a little bit blunt or maybe it's just even only part of the truth. But for me, the truth I'm really looking for is the result. And I don't want to be an arrogant person. I don't want to behave in ways that are counterproductive to the organization, but I also don't want to behave Mr. Nicey, Nicey, Nicey and not get anywhere either. And it seems to me that sometimes people struggle to get that balance between being the person they aspire to be on a personal level, but also being responsible for the results. What I'm hearing you say is finding your own path is totally fine. And I guess I just wanted to ask you about not so much the tension between being virtuous and results, because I don't think they have to be unrelated, but I wanted to talk a little bit about how you see them coexisting together.
Look, I think when we talk about those attributes, they are desirable and they are valuable and they do make a difference to how you can lead people. As you say, though, the result is the crunch, right? You have to have results. Otherwise, there's no point in trying to lead.
Totally.
And the thing that stops us, there are a number of things, but I think one of the main drivers as a leader that holds people back, this concept of being liked.
Mm.
And as humans, we seek affiliation, we seek inclusion, we seek acceptance, and it's in our DNA. And back for our forebears many generations ago, it was actually critical to survival. Now, it's not now, but it still operates on us subconsciously in that way.
Yes.
So the number one mantra for a leader has to be respect before popularity. And seeking respect before popularity means, if you can get this in your head and you can wrap your head around it, it puts you in a place where you go, this is not easy for me, but it's the right thing and it's what I'm paid to do as a leader.
Yeah.
And if you can get your head around that, it helps you to do things that you would otherwise avoid. And so many conflict-averse people I run into as leaders avoid the things that they should be doing that would both improve the performance of the organization and their team, and it would also be in the best interest of the people they're leading.
Yes.
This is the irony of it. It's the paradox, is that people who aren't stretched, who you just try and keep happy, they're not going to be satisfied in the long term. I believe that all self-esteem comes from achieving difficult things. That's it. Full stop. Or actually for my US audience, period. That's it. You think about it. When was the last time you felt absolutely bulletproof and unstoppable and on fire? It will have been just after you achieved something that either scared you or you thought you might not be able to achieve, or that really stretched you beyond where you thought you could stretch, whether it's running a marathon or going through childbirth or doing something at work. It doesn't matter. And those moments where your self-esteem grows, where you learn to have more confidence, where you understand the impact, the positive impact you can have, those are the moments where you grow. And if a leader doesn't actually take you out of that comfort zone to get you into that space, they're robbing you of that opportunity. So stretching people, we're afraid to do it because we're afraid of them not liking us because we're pushing them too hard. And everyone's different. Everyone takes different levels of stretch, obviously. But this principle of stretch your people to that limit, put that positive stress on them to get their performance to where they can achieve at the limits of their capability, that's where you're going to get them long-term happy, and they'll be so driven and so inspired and so motivated, you can't get that any other way. But you don't get through to that reward unless you can handle the conflict that happens on the way through, because people don't want to be stretched that much. I don't want to be stretched that much. I have to be pushed. Your very best people on their very best day, they'll give you 80 to 85% of what they're capable of.
Why do you think that is?
Because we're human. We like things to be comfortable.
Yeah.
We like things to be achievable. We like them to be certain. And we push for that. And it's the very rare individual who is constantly pushing that limit of how far can I go? It's the Alex Honnolds who free climb El Capitan. It's those extreme surfers and snowboarders who are doing things that we look at and just go, that is ridiculous.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah. It's those people that just want to stretch to their limit all the time. Because once they get that feeling of the stretch and the achievement, it's something that drives them, and it completely drives what they do.
Well, I'm hoping this conversation has stretched a few people's thinking around leadership. And as we wrap up, Martin, again, I want to express my thanks and gratitude to you for taking the time to come and hang with us today. I have one last question that I'd like to ask you, and then I'd also like to ask where we can get a hold of your book, because I think it's going to be an incredible read, and I can't wait to recommend it to our readers, to our listeners, I should say. The question I want to ask you about all of this is, clearly this is a process and a journey of self-discovery, self-improvements, and so on and so forth, for us to become the best version of ourselves, the leaders that we are capable of becoming. When that happens and people fulfill that potential, just so that we can really articulate the rewards on the other side of that journey, what happens? What do you see? What have you observed? What are the outcomes or the impact that is felt or experienced by people who not only develop their own leadership and fulfill their potential, but help others do the same?
Yes, and for me, that's the payback for leadership. There's a lot of hard stuff to do in leading people. So as a leader, when you see that rare person, and they are rare, it's not 90% of your team, it's 10 to 20% of your team that actually get the hang of this and go with it and embrace it. When you see those moments, that's when you stand back and say, all that stuff I went through was completely worth it. Now, you mightn't feel that way at the time. I've run a few marathons in my time, and if you ask me 5 minutes after I finish a marathon, when my next one is, I say, I'm never doing that again.
Yeah.
That was ridiculous, right? But with the passage of time, you recover, you heal, and then a couple of months later, you're looking at the calendar. What's the next marathon I can run? It's ludicrous, right? But the pain dissipates, the glory remains.
Yes.
And then you want to stretch yourself again, because you remember the feeling of that glory. And it's the same as a leader. once you get that feeling of, oh my goodness, I can see what's happened now. And it was really hard on the way through, but that was completely worth it, unimaginably worth it. And it's when you see an individual genuinely change, because it affects their whole life, not just their work, it affects their whole life. I remember a guy, if we just have 1 minute,
who
was working in an industrial business that I worked in, that I was a leader in. He was a few layers away from me. But he was a guy who'd been in the business for a really long time, and he was approaching retirement age. And when he was given that empowerment and autonomy we spoke about earlier to fix some of the things that had always irked him, and finally had some control and some influence to have some impact in his environment, he was a completely different person. And the way he changed physically from being a guy who looked every bit his age and had stooped shoulders and moved slowly and everything else, to a guy who walked briskly with his shoulders back with a smile on his face, he was exactly the same human, but not completely different, because he worked out that doing those things and taking on accountability for himself and making a difference was highly impactful, and he could actually control his environment. Now, the sad thing is that he was in his late 50s before he got to experience that. Imagine if a leader had given him that opportunity when he was in his mid-20s.
Wow.
It would have completely changed the trajectory of his career and potentially his life to have had that feeling gifted to him by a leader earlier on, a leader who was prepared to let him have a go and to hold him to account for what he was doing and to show him that he could actually be more than he was. Now, that sounds a little bit airy-fairy and inspirational, but that's ultimately what it was.
No, but it also sounds uplifting as well. And I think that's the key, is if we get this right, the rewards are immense. And absolutely, so it's worth the journey is really the point of all of that. Martin, you have been very, very generous with your time, and I'm really grateful to you for taking that time to share your insights and your knowledge and your experience, because what you're speaking from is from a place of experience rather than hypothetical or academic learning. When your book comes out, and where is the best place to get a hold of the book, please? How can people get onto that?
So it's actually being published in the US initially by Rosetta Books, Simon & Schuster. And the best place to get it is from my website. So it's martingmoore.com. martingmoore.com will show you how to order it for Australian audiences, because we're shipping it out here, and also if you're international. So martingmoore.com. If you want to find out more about us, we're on social media at Your CEO Mentor. So Your CEO Mentor is the name of our corporate business. And if you follow us on any of the social channels, LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook, we're there.
Great. Well, mate, once again, thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk to us. You've been an absolute treat to talk to. And as I said to you at the outset, one of my friends has been, you know, on at me for a while now to talk to you. And I understand completely why, because I've been scribbling some notes here, and lots of pearls of wisdom, lots of, you know, nuggets of gold that people are going to be able to take away and not just learn, but to implement and improve their own journey. So once again, mate, from all of us here, I appreciate you. You're a good man.
Thanks, Jesse. It's been an absolute pleasure, mate. Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast with Dr. Jesse Green. For more free tools and resources, join the free Facebook group. Visit drjessegreen.com/Facebook. And for more episodes, visit drjessegreen.com/savvydentist.